This is Carla, and welcome back to There Might Be Cupcakes. Just a note, this episode is about finding cupcakes in extremely difficult or shocking places, and the stories involved come from two disparate sources. One is from my life, and one is from the writer and singer Leonard Cohen. And yeah, heads up, this is a trigger warning for extremely difficult life circumstances, namely rape and suicide. This is a ultimately, I truly hope, uplifting episode, but it gets dark in order to get light, because as both Leonard and I know, light is defined by its relationship to darkness. If you bear with me, if you bear with us, I believe these two stories will be well worth your while this holiday season, and might remind you of something you're looking for, if I might be so bold. They both did this very thing for me, the first way back in the 1990s. I can't believe I can say that phrase, way back in the 1990s. Ouch. And the second, just the other day. Please, if you're able, have a listen. If not, I understand. And maybe save this download for a sunnier day with my love and understanding. Before I begin, for new listeners, this is what I mean about finding and making cupcakes. My podcast was named for my friend Gregory Barrett's comedy routine, There Might Be Cake. In it, he talks about getting out and doing the damn thing, because in doing so, you might actually be near cake, and you might get some. Go to work when it's hard, and there might be a party that day in the break room, and there might be cake, and you might get some. And then you just extend that metaphor to life. If you just try, and you push that one time when you think you can't do something, you might be there, wherever there is, and there might be an emotional place instead of a physical place, when cake might be found. You can play the video of this routine on the front page of my website. Just scroll down on theremightbecupcakes.com, or you can listen to it on Apple Music or Spotify. Those links are in the show notes. The routine is on Greg's album, Original Uncool. Well, I extended the metaphor to cupcakes for many reasons. One big one is that cupcakes are egalitarian. They're the same shape and size when baked appropriately in the right pan, and we can all use a little fairness right now. Another is that cupcakes can be decorated with abandon, depending on how you feel. Anything from naked on top, no icing, to bedazzled with edible pearls, sprinkles and glitter, however you feel. Cupcakes are my metaphor for the extra things that make life worth it, for the special things that we might miss if we don't live wide open. Cupcakes this time of year can be a metaphor for the holiday spirit, including the spirit of Advent, which is basically the idea of being slower and more open and waiting, taking our time with the darkening of the light and just being with what's there, allowing what is to be, allowing what is to happen. Advent is derived from the Latin adventus, meaning arrival, coming. And so we wait and we discover our own small lights and we hopefully see each other's in the growing gloaming. And that brings me to my two stories. Leonard Cohen's story, which I read this week from the epilogue of his final collection of poetry, art, and lyrics, titled The Flame, reminded me of my story, so I will tell mine first, because Leonard's gives the fire and the punch to mine. Mine is the kindling to his larger flame, I think. Leonard Cohen spent his life's work, his poetry and his prose and lyrics and music, dancing around the themes of darkness and light and flame and fire. In this time of Advent, when the days are darkening and the time is meant to be quiet and contemplative, this story of another, differently dark time, when I first learned to sit with myself and contemplate the uncontemplatable, is serendipity. My story dates back to graduate school, Boston, 1993. I was struggling with what I did not understand was PTSD symptoms from the sexual and physical assault I experienced in 1991, at the hands of my ex-boyfriend in my first apartment in my very first home of my own. I talked about this, what happened, in detail in the episode This Girl Just Had a Bad Date, and if you're interested, that episode is linked in the show notes. All I knew is that I couldn't have sexual intercourse without pain. I startled at noises, and I was startling myself at my attraction to strangers. I was scaring myself, in other words. It was that complicated, and it was that simple. So I poked about, not admitting to myself that I was poking about for help, and I found the Boston University-sponsored rape support group for university students in the area. And it was just down the street from my brownstone. not feeling that I belonged because I was not really raped. And back then, the precise language of that was everything. I went anyway, dragging my boots down Bay State Avenue and up the stoop to the small meeting room. And there I met with a ragtag but strong group of young women students. Once, twice, three times. And I kept coming back. I didn't talk much, but I kept coming back. One session I arrived early, and only one other girl was there. By then I knew her story, and it was beyond brutal, beyond even breath. She had been the voice of the male crew team at her university. The cry over the water early mornings calling strokes and keeping those strong men in line, in time. Those men were her family, her best friends. She coached them and helped them train and took care of their crew equipment so that they could successfully fly across the surface of the Charles River like gods. And then one night at a campus party, they all raped her, all of her friends. So we two sat quietly together before that session when we both arrived early in an Advent-like space. Waiting and simply sitting with what was there and waiting for what was to come in silent contemplation together. And then I noticed her socks. Her very loud socks. I don't remember the pattern now. It's been over 26 years. But her socks were bright and lively and cheerful in a way that deliberately and elaborately raged against our safe space of pain. So I told her I liked them. And she told me the story of her socks. She told me that she always tried to wear happy socks. That's what she called them. It was the first time I'd ever heard the phrase. Every day she made a point, no matter how ragged or sad or desperate she felt, to put on happy socks. That way, she told me very deliberately, making careful eye contact with me for the first, and I think only time, in that group therapy space, when she was feeling panicked or empty or dead inside, when she felt the weight of what had happened to her, when her professor sounded like an adult in the Charlie Brown cartoons, wah, 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 and she just couldn't think or breathe one more breath. She could catch a glimpse of one leg crossed over the other, or catch a glimpse of her foot as she reached down to grab her bag and just run. She would see her socks and see daisies or Keith Haring's art, or bright blocks of color, or Snoopy, and her happy socks would jolt her brain, just enough. A kickstart, an adrenaline shot to her heart. She told me you have to smile when you look at happy socks, even when all of your friends have betrayed your body and soul. The surprise of your silly feet has to make you smile, just a little, even though. I have worn happy socks of many different types ever since that day, and I have thought of her when I do. I catch glimpses of my own ankles or feet, sometimes when I'm in my wheelchair, sometimes when I'm in my bed, and I hope that she owns a million pairs by now. I hope she owns a happy socks company, or I hope that she found that one pair that she has to wear every single day and then rinse out in the sink because they give her such a lift. But I hope they did keep her keeping on, because that day and that small moment in that very small group therapy room, when two kids were early for group, she changed my life. And I cannot describe exactly how, but I am better for it. We change each other's lives in such small ways, and we don't ever even know it. And these moments are the cupcakes. And sometimes it is heartbreaking when we never realize our importance to each other, our ability to make cupcakes for each other. And this leads me to Leonard Cohen's story, which I will read verbatim, because fuck me for trying to reword that poet's story. He told this story upon accepting an award. And now I'm going to tell you very briefly a story of how I got my song. Because I was an indifferent guitar player, I banged the chords. I only knew a few of them. I sat around with my college friends, drinking and singing the folk songs or the popular songs of the day, but I never in a thousand years thought of myself as a musician or a singer. One day in the early 60s, I was visiting my mother's house in Montreal. The house is beside a park, and in the park there's a tennis court where many people come to watch the beautiful young tennis players enjoy their sport. I wandered back to this park, which I'd known since my childhood, and there was a young man playing a guitar. He was playing a flamenco guitar, and he was surrounded by two or three girls and boys who were listening to him. I loved the way he played. There was something about the way he played that captured me. It was the way I wanted to play, and I knew I'd never be able to play. And so I sat there with the other listeners for a few moments, and when there was a silence, an appropriate silence, I asked him if he would give me guitar lessons. He was a young man from Spain, and we could only communicate in my broken French and his broken French. He didn't speak English, and he agreed to give me guitar lessons. I pointed to my mother's house, which you could see from the tennis court, and we made an appointment. We settled the price. And he came to my mother's house the next day, and he said, "Let me hear you play something." I tried to play something. He said, "You don't know how to play, do you?" I said, "No, I really don't know how to play." He said, "First of all, let me tune your guitar. It's all out of tune." So he took the guitar and he tuned it. He said, "It's not a bad guitar. It wasn't my Conde, but it wasn't a bad guitar." So he handed it back to me. He said, "Now play." I couldn't play any better. He said, "Let me show you some chords." And he took the guitar and he produced a sound from the guitar that I'd never heard. And he played a sequence of chords with a tremolo and he said, "Now you do it." I said, "It's out of the question. I couldn't possibly do it." He said, "Let me put your fingers in the frets." And he put my fingers in the frets and he said, now play." It was a mess. He said, "I'll come back tomorrow." He came back tomorrow. He put my hands on the guitar. He placed it on my lap in a way that was appropriate, and I began again with those six chords, the six chord progression that many, many flamenco songs are based upon. I was a little better that day. The third day, improved, somewhat improved. But I knew the chords now, and I knew that although I couldn't coordinate my fingers with my thumb to produce the correct tremolo pattern, I knew the chords. I knew them very, very well by this point. The next day, he didn't come. He didn't come. I had the number of his boarding house in Montreal. I phoned to find out why he had missed the appointment, and they told me that he'd taken his life, that he'd committed suicide. I knew nothing about the man. I did not know what part of Spain he came from. I did not know why he came to Montreal. I did not know why he stayed there. I did not know why he appeared there in that tennis court. I did not know why he took his life. I was deeply saddened, of course. But now I disclose something that I've never spoken in public. It was those six chords. It was that guitar pattern that has been the basis of all my songs and all my music. Whatever you celebrate this season of quiet waiting and of hope, light a candle for the poet Leonard Cohen and for his guitar teacher and whatever he was suffering, and for my Happy Socks teacher, in hopes that she is well and whole today. And I shall light a candle for you, my dear listeners, for I am grateful for you every single day. And a special sparkle of gratitude to my listeners in Bolivia. For I saw when gathering links for the show notes that I am newly on the charts for Bolivia in arts and entertainment on Spotify. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening, and I send my love to you from this eastern coast of America. There will be more holiday fare to follow very shortly, more Victorian holiday history like last year, and yes, more Christmas horror like last year. Soon, soon. I have missed talking to all of you as I always do. Relevant episode titles to this episode: My Own Sexual Assault, This Girl Just Had a Bad Date, and A Different World. That one is in the wider perspective of the Bill Cosby trial and growing up in the Cosby era. Christmas episodes from last year: What the Dickens, and Victorian Christmas, The Goblin and the Paw. All four of the above are linked in the show notes, as is Leonard Cohen's book The Flame, and is Leonard Cohen's music. There's also a link for my favorite set of Happy Socks, which are pictured in this episode's image. See you soon. I love you. And please stay tuned for a promo for a fellow Lady Pod Squad bookish podcast, Shelf Addiction. Her website link is in the show notes as well. The excerpt I read is from Leonard Cohen's acceptance speech for the Prince of Asturias Award on October 21st, 2011. The full acceptance speech begins on page 267 of The Flame by Leonard Cohen, which is linked in the show notes.
Have you ever finished a book and wondered, what do I read next? Or wished that you were in a book club, but everyone you know says they don't have time to read? Maybe you enjoy audiobooks or are looking to try a new-to-you genre, author, or narrator. Hi, I'm Tamara, and I have a shelf addiction. I read books, listen to audiobooks, and I'm here to share with you the best of the best and to warn you off of the worst. I hope to open your mind to new and awesome books to feed your inner book nerd. I have a unique and honest perspective, and I look forward to talking books with you. From entertaining book chats and interviews to 5-minute book reviews, there's something for every type of reader on the Shelf Addiction Podcast. Subscribe for free on your podcatcher of choice by going to shelfaddiction.com/podcast, and you too can have a shelf addiction.